Okay, thank you very much. I'm actually doing this talk for my colleague Adele Houghton, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. And I'm going to talk about no relationships disclosed. I'm going to be talking about some toolkits. They're basically some documents, two documents. I'll show you those in a second for building capacity at local public health departments. But how many people here are from local health departments? One person? No. Okay, at least, yeah, a few. So everybody else is very curious about this anyway. That's good. So so I'll just go to the end of the slide, the end of the presentation, to give you the bottom line. I'll just make this really quick. No. You probably should put this first, but these are the two documents. I don't have any hard copies because this is a climate change thing, right? What would I do that? You would laugh at me. But these are the two documents. You can get them both online. So this first document I'm going to talk about, I didn't work on, but Adele did. So probably direct, more detailed questions. I did look at it briefly, so I knew a little bit what I was talking about. And the second one I worked on with Adele, this was through the Council of State and Territorial Epidemiologists. So we have a climate change work group, and if people are interested, see me afterwards, because we're always trying to recruit new members. And we actually just had that accepted for publication, and I don't have the journal name or reference, but I could, send it to him if you give your card. So now I'll start back again. So why focus on local health departments? And a lot of the work I've done since I come from the state health department and work at the federal level has been really focused more on the national issues about building capacity to address climate change, whether they're developing indicators, vulnerability assessments, or projecting future impacts. But when you really think about it, all the action is going to be happening at the local level when we have these climate change issues. And so the local health departments really are the ones that need to be prepared and thinking about this more. Just thinking about some of the stuff, all the different things that happened around Hurricane Katrina. There's existing programs already. All hazard approach that many local health departments are taking. So they've already had this framework, and it's kind of easy to add this next little piece of becoming climate ready into these local health departments. We're going to talk about this first document. So this gives you a framework for integrating climate planning into local health departments. So it's really focused on building, sustain, and institutional capacity, and it can be done at little or no cost. I mean, that's kind of one of the objections people see. They say, oh, we already have, a disaster program, and now we're going to have to, we have to do another whole, train extra people for climate programs. And that really the key thing out of this document is that it gives you some information on how to leverage your existing resources that already may exist at the local level to build this capacity. And I think, I already mentioned a lot of these things. And it will end up making economic sense. If you start looking, and that probably should starting to be your argument, is more around economics. I'm kind of convinced on that. You're gonna be able to start presenting information about how much money the local districts are going to lose if they're not ready to respond to these issues. And lots of times it can already fit into your programs or your department's current priorities. So how do you do this? We have a framework in this document, or I should say Adele does, on gathering data on how climate is likely to impact your already existing public health priorities. So other people, whether it's your executive management or decision makers, they'll probably have some top priorities, and you'll be able to see how they will impact those priorities that may be slightly different. The collaboration is really key because, if you are going to be doing this without a lot of impacts on budget, you're going to have to get key collaborators, and you can make these connections to bring in some of the expertise you may not have. So how do you build these external collaborators? Adele has done some work down in Texas area, and she had an approach of really bringing people to the table and saying, hey, this is, what the value will be for us and for you, and together we can to work together to develop a better response for future climate impacts. And there's information in this document on how building a formal process to build a relationship, how you need to be, you know, continuing to follow up and do evaluation activities as you're moving the process along. So how do you, and then the messaging and, of course, the communication is key, because in every local area is going to be different. There's going to be different ways of communicating to the population affected. Do the messages go through public service announcements? Can they be incorporated in already things that the community is worried about? Let's say it's gets ready for heat each year. Well, you need to put climate messaging in those messages about heat is coming, and guess what? This area is going to be getting warmer. We have a very strong quantitative data on this, we can predict the impacts of heat, and this is due to climate change and our global warming. So, it's very important to look at what are the public perceptions of risks about a lot of related issues, because they'll have a lot of misperceptions, as you know, the media is always going back and forth on this and not accurately portraying the risk. So you're going to need to be developing messaging, accurate messaging to portray that. Now this next document comes out of work at CSTE, the State Environmental Health Indicator Collaborative. We've been working on this for quite a number of years, and we've come up with quite a few measures that look at environmental hazards that are associated with climate change, measures around exposure, measures around health effects of climate change impacts, and also intervention measures. And these could be adaptation, vulnerability indicators, policy indicators. When we developed these, though, again, as I started the talk, these were all thought of doing at the statewide level, and there seemed to be quite a bit of interest on how do we downsize these, how do we push these indicators down to a more local level. This document then talks about how you can use a couple of existing frameworks, I'll mention them in a minute, to develop local indicators, how you can connect your department to get more technical assistance on this, and how you can find out where the available data sets are. So this is kind of the three-tier system, getting started, a vulnerable assessment, and predicting future impacts in your area. This is a little bit of a busy slide, but this is kind of the process we've outlined, identifying first the highest priority climate change hazard in your community. So I mentioned heat, it could be flooding, it could be a whole list. You could look at other communities and see what they've chosen already. There's two sets of indicators ready for you to use that's at the state level. They might not all be, there might not be data for all of these at the local level, but these are both from the National Environmental Health Tracking Network has developed a suite of these indicators along with the CSTE CIIC indicators. Those are available on their websites. There may be more granulated data from instead of using some of these state or national sources. And you're going to want to go for the higher resolution data if you can find it. And the first thing to do then is you need a baseline set. What is the baseline so you can track changes over time. Now, when you get down to this local level, you're going to maybe find there's gaps and you won't be able to have quantitative data for all these things. So you may need to take other approaches, whether they're focus groups, key informant interviews, oral histories, and you may have to be assembling some data yourself. And then integrating these environmental public health indicators on climate change into your overall local surveillance program. The next step is the vulnerability assessment. You want to talk about what is the definition of exposure based on the hazards, and using the example of heat again, what constitutes a heat event, for example, in a local community? Well, a place that's really hot, it's maybe 100 degrees isn't, nobody even cares about it. A place like San Francisco, we have a couple of days of 90 degree weather, that's a heat event. So you need to take some flexibility in defining these local indicators. There's going to be information on historical trends for those measures. So you'll want to look at trends both on the exposure and then try to collect information about illnesses and deaths related to these exposures. So, for example, again, you could be looking at heat emergency room visits and hospitalizations and deaths. You're going to have special vulnerable populations in your area, and you're going to know what those are, or you may have to be doing, again, some of these methods I mentioned earlier to find out what they are. Are they, you know, is it the poor, is it the elderly, is it children? And these vulnerable populations will change with the climate change threat that you're interested in. Looking at elements of the natural and built environment that communicate to community vulnerability, their cooling centers, are there parks, open spaces, all these factors are really important. And then creating a vulnerability index by combining the sociodemographic data together with the environmental data. And then finally, the third tier, we're doing okay on time so far? Yeah. This one is probably the most difficult. When I talked about technical assistance, this is something where you may want to be hoping to collaborate with, you know, university partners. You're going to be needing to get some downscale climate change projection data. This could be temperature data, precipitation data, for example. And then you're going to need to use those projections to some anticipated changes in the structure in your population. So in other words, is this population aging? Are there certain groups moving in and out? And you can get some of those data from the census and other groups that do projections of distributions of populations in the future. And then estimating mortality or morbidity, if you can do that, for your priority environmental hazards. And then you want to compare your projected changes with what was the historical trends in some of these conditions. And also, as I mentioned before, the economic cost issue is very important. So that would be really great to be estimating not only the future burden of illness and death, but what is the future burden of cost in the future for these events. So some of the other additional uses that we discuss in this document is you can use these indicators to support delivery of the 10 essential services of public health. And I don't have these listed, but I think many of you know what these are. For example, you know, conducting surveillance, doing evaluation. There's a BRACE framework that the CDC has that they funded a number of states. Many of you are probably familiar with this. And this framework, BRACE, is Building Resistance Against Climate Effects. And this framework, these indicators does support that framework also. And then, supporting your local climate change and public health policies. And now we're back where we started. Here's the documents again. Adele worked on this first one. This was that had funding from the CDC. That's BioCitu. That's her group that she runs. And the second document again was funded through CSTE and CDC. And this is the link down at the bottom. Now is the journal article. That's, if you want to just read the short version, that's the journal article link. Also for that manual in a more discussion form.